coming to you loud and clear. Like it rained everyone's attention.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Katie.
Hi, how's it going?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Welcome to the Healer Hip Hop Podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here with us. Today with us is Katie Yenderly. Did I pronounce it right?
You did.
I did some research.
it's a common problem, but yeah, you did it right. Thank you.
Okay, great. Yeah, I invited you for the interview because I saw that you're going to publish a book called God Save the Queens, The Essential History of Women in Hip Hop.
Yes. In a month from now, a month and a week, at least in the United States, it releases October 22nd. I'm not sure anywhere else, but what the date is.
I guess it will be there will be a Kindle edition or something, or an ebook.
Yeah, there'll be ebook. There's an audio book.
So I'm pretty sure it will be available over here too. And that sounds really great. I had an interview with a German guest, and we talked about women in hip hop. That was like 2 years ago. And now it's super interesting to have you here and to continue the conversation because it's about time, right?
Yeah, it is about time. It's a long time coming, definitely.
So in the beginning, could you please introduce yourself a little bit, to people who don't know you and haven't heard of you?
Sure, yeah. I'm Kathy Yenderly. I'm a journalist. Primarily covering hip hop and just women's studies issues and things of that nature. And I'm an author. This is my second book. The first one was Commissary Kitchen, which was a prison cookbook that I did with the late Prodigy from Mobb Deep. So yeah, you know, for about 20 years now, this has kind of been my thing, my career, my passion. And yeah, I mean, I guess that's basically it. You know, hip-hop has been a huge part of my life since day one, but I made it a career about 20 years ago, and I haven't stopped since.
Yeah. So you said it's been hip-hop has been with you, from the start. Tell us a little bit about the little Kathy and where she's from and how she came to love hip-hop.
Well, I was born and raised in New Jersey, And you know, my family is from Paterson, New Jersey. My mom, we had a house in Hawthorne, which is, you know, a neighboring town. But I went to school in Paterson, and I spent, you know, most of my time there. My mom was a teacher in Paterson, which is just kind of the neighboring city. You know, it's like think of like Paterson as like a really big city, and then Hawthorne is like a little tiny suburb outside of Paterson. And I had this like really interesting duality of all day being in the inner city, and then in the evening and on weekends I was in the suburbs. You know, but I went to school in Paterson, and very early on, I used to write raps about soap operas when I was in third grade.
About soap operas. Okay.
Yeah, I used to watch soap opera. I know the my big one, that I thought was my big hit. Like, I still have it memorized and I'm not going to recite it, but I used to write these raps about the soap opera. I don't know what I was doing, you know, because my mom was a big soap opera fan, and I don't know, I felt like it needed a new theme song. I don't know, but I'm not gonna mark that as my entry point into hip hop as being a third grade soap opera rhymer. But it was one of those things where I think, you know, at that age when I guess 9 years old, at that point in time, you're talking about entering into the golden era of hip hop. That golden age was timed to my, you know, third grade experience. And, you know, hip hop was a huge part. Don't mind, I have a choking dog that's just coughing next to us here. She has allergies. So
don't worry.
That's, so that was kind of my the time period that hip hop became a part of, you know, my existence. But it wasn't until I was maybe like probably about 12 years old when I really, really was into it, because at that point, that's when, you know, TLC had just come out and Salt and Pepper had been doing their thing. And a lot of other groups that really spoke to me in their own ways. You know, when you come as in your life, when you come across this threshold, right, where you're, you know, you're going into preteen, teenage years, music changes for you, right? And I mean, as a child, you're like, you know, especially in America, you're wrapped up in this whole boy band craze. You know, at that point, it was like New Kids on the Block and,
same,
you know,
yeah.
New Edition.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. So yeah. When you cross over to that time period of like that 12, 13-year-old mark where, you know, those things aren't as cool as they were a few years prior, and you start searching for something else and your identity is changing and you're growing up, that was the starting point, I think, for me when hip hop really, really, really took a hold. And yeah, I mean, I credit TLC. I mean, I listened to everything. I mean, when, like, you know, over the years, I got really, really into hip hop, especially like even the underground culture. But TLC was the one that, like, when I think about the group that kind of changed me, it was T-Boz, Left Eye, and Chilli, mm-hmm. for sure. And then came Lauryn Hill with the Fugees. You know, Blunted on Reality was like just a few years later. So it was continuous from that point on.
Same. Like Fugees was my entry group for the culture. And then Lauryn Hill touched me a lot. Yeah.
Yeah.
So did you feel strongly like about women at that time already? Or did you even think about, like me, I didn't. I just consumed all kinds of hip hop that touched me and didn't think much of women in hip hop, especially.
Well, I thought it was really, really cool that girls were doing it, because, I mean, like I said, you're coming off like a boy band craze. I mean, and, you know, prior to that, I was like listening to artists like Debbie Gibson and Tiffany, and, you know, but I think, you know, when you were looking at like the bigger picture, right? And you see this big picture of all of these artists, and there's a lot of men that are leading the charge, right? Mm-hmm. And then you see a sprinkling in of women. It's amazing. And I think that's what I extracted. I was like, wait a minute, you know, like, look at that. Like, that's so cool. And I think, you know, I definitely knew the difference that women were doing something. Like I saw it, and yeah, I was drawn to that. I think, you know, and maybe little Kathy thought that she was going to be a rapper. I don't know what it was, but just to see someone that you can in some way identify with felt really cool.
Yeah. So you then came to write for many different magazines and other blogs. Can you name some of them? Like I saw like Vice magazine and.
Yeah, when I started writing originally, it was on the Roots OK Player message boards. They had this section called The Lesson, and I would write these long drawn out think pieces defending like Lauryn Hill. I don't know.
You have to start somewhere.
I used to think, I was like thinking about it in retrospect, I was like, wow, you are extra. But yeah. It was around that time, like 1999, that I was like, really thought I, you know, banging my fist on the table, like, what's up? But yeah, I started at this period where the internet, you know, the two didn't really see eye to eye. And I can't say that I had like this foresight into like the landscape of hip hop media or just journalism in general. But I knew that I wanted to have this balance, right? So I would write for digital publications and I would write for print publications. So I started writing for All Hip Hop, the web. And at the time, you know, they were the biggest hip hop website. And then I was writing for like a small LA-based hip hop magazine called Rhyme, and from there it became, it went to The Source, you know, and then I did some other indie things. I even wrote for some zines, but from that point on, you know, The Source became Vibe, Vibe became Rolling Stone, became, and then as the two worlds kind of came together, the publications, you know, the digital versus print changed as well. And then, you know, Pitchfork came in, Village Voice, Billboard, Vice, ID, The Guardian, you know, Playboy. Over the years, I just kept going with it. And I tried first and foremost to make hip hop the focal point, especially the further I got into the mainstream, because I was reading these articles in these like fashion magazines and these other magazines where, you know, they were trying to like, I don't know, kind of just zone in on hip hop, but the way it was being covered was, it felt artificial. And, you know, sometimes the journalists just didn't really understand the artists, and being given the opportunity to write for the mainstream, I wanted hip hop to be represented properly and the artists to be treated properly and interviewed properly. So that's what I did. And, you know, I think the coolest thing I was able to do in that regard was do a spread with Fetty Wap from Maxim, because they had him in these like designer suits, and he's from Patterson as well. So we were able to do the interview in Patterson. It was a really cool experience. And just being able to cover him for Maxim at the time that, you know, Trap Queen was really big. That was really cool to do. I really enjoyed that. And Fetty was awesome. And, you know, he was just so engaging, and just being able to speak about, you know, where we were both from in a sense. It was a really great experience.
Nice. What are some female artists of that time, of that era, that you interviewed and got to know or meet or write about?
Well, someone who I love and adore is Rhapsody. You know, I've been I've interviewed Rhapsody many times, and you know, she's a dear friend of mine, and I love just seeing how she's, you know, evolving in this whole glow up, and it's just so well deserved. So, you know, she's one who I've spoken to quite a bit. But, you know, I've interviewed Lil Kim, Nicki Minaj, Rob Digga, Remy Ma. I mean, there was a time period where for ID, I had a column where I was breaking female hip hop acts. And that was a point that I felt was really cool, because, you know, it was right around the time Remy was released from prison, and I was actually her first interview out, and you know, she opened my column, and you know, through that column I got to break a lot of artists. Like I wrote about Lakaylee 47 and Dreezy. That was a really cool time period. I keep using cool like over and over again. I'm sorry. but it was a fulfilling time period. But yeah, I mean, I've spoken to a lot of women in hip hop for the last two decades. You know, I've tried to make sure that I was able to not only, you know, it was a weird time period, just this whole span of time, if we're counting from when I first started writing until now, because I write during the Lauryn Hill reign, and at that point, you know, by like 2000, 2001, you know, Lauryn was a little absent, and there was just this
a little absent. That's very well said. Yeah, for just like 10 years or something.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, so you're getting all of these other artists that are coming in, and, you know, some are making huge hits, and others are, you know, making one single and kind of vanishing. And then there's a lot in the underground. So I tried, you know, to make sure that I spoke with a lot of women. For all hip hop, I remember my second interview ever for them was with Ladybug Mecca on her first solo project. And that was awesome. You know, I got to go to Brooklyn and she was doing a video shoot, and she's amazing. I love her. But yeah, that was probably my second or third interview ever. was with mm-hmm. with Ladybug Mecca, at least for like a big publication.
Mm-hmm.
You know, outside of countless think pieces on Lauryn Hill, of course.
Yeah. What's interesting was, like, I was thinking, when I think of history of women in hip hop, I thought back, like, okay, yeah, there was the Lauryn Hill era and maybe Queen Latifah and other artists. And then there seemed to be like a 10-year gap. I don't really remember artists from like 2000 to 2000, I don't know, maybe 10, 12 or something. I can't really recall like many women that influenced me during that time, or maybe I was just not listening much, but like now there seems to be like a new wave of women, and especially since you mentioned Rhapsody, who just I love her new album, where she, it's like a kind of homage to women, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there seems mm-hmm. to be this new wave. Do you feel the same, like there was a little gap, or is it just my perspective, like maybe I just didn't look close enough?
Well, I think what actually happened, you know, and I kind of grappled with this while I was doing, right, is because we view that chunk of time, right, as a gap, right? Like women just after Lauryn Hill, room fell silent, right?
Mm-hmm.
When really that wasn't the case. The difference was, you know, I mean, because remember, Missy Elliott released albums consistently at that point.
True.
Until 2005. So we had like a solid 6 years. Mm-hmm. Trina was still out there doing it. You know,
yeah.
Eve was out.
Oh, yeah, it's true. Oh, yeah, and she was huge,
But I think what was happening at that in that time period, and let's be honest, it arguably stopped around 2008, well, 2009, let's say, when Nicki Minaj emerged, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
But for that chunk of time, and let's call it the 10 years in between the last time we saw Lauryn Hill and the first time we saw Nicki, right? We'll call it a decade. I mean, we're calling it like eight. It's really like 8 years, but let's just mm-hmm. call it a decade to round up, right?
Mm-hmm.
During that time period, women were no longer being marketed as a novelty act, which is something that they were doing in between the years of like, particularly 1996 to 1999, right? With the first entry point of Lil' Kim and Foxy Brown, and then Lauryn Hill, specifically, and Rod Zicka, and even Eve and Missy Elliott. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
That idea that, you know, oh, look what's going on. And I think, you know, what started to happen was during that 10-year period, there was just a lot of shuffling around of women, and they were no longer the novelty acts, because then what happened was, you know, Biggie passed away in 97, a year before that, you know, Tupac died. We were now entering into what is now deemed as the shiny suit era. So hip hop was becoming, you know, super wealthy. And that was like the primary focus, mm-hmm. as mainstream as possible, as flashy.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, the emergence of Jay-Z, it's a lot harder to offer like an alternative, especially in the form of a woman, to the mainstream landscape when there was so much going on. And, you know, as we learned, you know, like I discuss in my book, what labels started to do. I mean, also think about this. 1999 marks the year that Napster came, and the RIAA in this country. Yes,
true. Yeah,
started
true.
To lose a ton of money.
Mm.
So who are the artists that get swept under the rug? Women.
Mm-hmm.
So they're out there. They're doing their thing. They're releasing records to the people who are gravitating toward them. But label budgets were not being placed in the way of these artists, you know, and I do talk about that in the book, because it's like, you know, we were viewing it as this time period of nothing, when really it was going on. We just weren't, you know, given the opportunity to see it just, you know, face forward the way we were a couple of years prior. So, yeah, I mean, in a sense, it's kind of like, you know, if the tree falls in the forest, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
If you can't hear it.
Yeah.
You know, whatever. Yeah. But things were going on. There was a lot of brilliant artists releasing their work. You know, it just wasn't as in our face as it was, you know, prior to that.
Yeah. So you being an author for so long, what made you finally think like, yeah, I have to write a book about the history of women in hip hop?
Well, you know, about 10 years before, actually, like right before Nicki Minaj came, you know, I don't want to say came to be. She was doing it for a few years prior, but before Nicki Minaj became popular, I wanted to do this book. And, you know, I was told that the same thing that you're saying. It's like, well, there was like this like awkward silence when it came to women. So who are you going to end it with? Like Lauren, you know what I mean? There's not another artist, you know? And it was like crazy because like Missy Elliott was doing it and, you know, she never entered the conversations with some of these publishers. Like it was just like, oh, I don't know. I don't really see that being a hot topic, you know? And it was, you know, conversations like that.
It's true. It wasn't like, I feel like there's a new feminist wave or a new wave like of appreciating women more or yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I got to this time, this period of my career where, you know, I had been approached to do, you know, some other books and I was like, man, you know, we're talking now like 4 decades plus and there's not a single book about this, you know, and really when is the good time? The time is now. So that's how it happened. It just, the timing felt right. I mean, because there was just nothing. You read hip hop books and it's like one page about women.
Yeah.
All lumped together and it's always like titled like, you know, ladies are doing it or, you know, and obviously ladies first and all this other stuff. And it's like, it's just treated like just this isolated moment. And it's like, no, I mean, women have been here, you know, and we're not hearing the stories, at least collectively. So that's just something I wanted to do.
Yeah. That's what I mean. That's why I wanted to talk to you because I felt like, oh my God, like, where has this book been? It's about time. Like, it felt so natural to see this title. And at the same time, I was like, oh my God, there was nothing that I saw before, like, covering this special topic. Yeah.
It's weird. It's actually just, it's, you know, as someone who is a hip hop book nerd, you know, I've read all of these books and I think the book Yes, Yes, Y'all covered women, I think the most extensively out of the many hip hop books that we can fill a library with. But still, it was one of these situations where I was just like, wait a minute. there's no better time than now. And, you know, especially the rise of like Nicki Minaj and Cardi B and now Megan Thee Stallion, when you're seeing just this consistency, it's like, yeah, I think now is a great time to do this.
Absolutely. So is there anything while you wrote the book, is there anything you were like, oh my God, wow, I didn't know this, or I don't know, did you find anything new that you weren't aware of before?
Yeah, a lot, a lot. I thought I knew, but I had no idea. Particularly the early stuff when it came to the pioneers, and then shortly thereafter, the whole reign of Roxanne Shanté. You don't realize. Well, a couple of things. I didn't realize just how young the pioneers of hip hop, right? You know, because even though I entered hip hop as like a 7th or 8th grade, you know, in this country, is like 12, 13-year-old fan, right? Even though I entered at that age. Like, and I was just a fan, you know? Mm-hmm. I'm not out creating music outside of my 9-year-old raps, right? But but imagine at that age, at 12 or 13, you're now going outside and you're writing these songs and you're performing these songs. And that was the median age of the pioneers of hip hop. We're talking 13 years old, between 13 and 16 years old. So all these stories that we read about within the history of hip hop, right? You're talking about like a 14-year-old doing it. You know, I think Kool Herc was like 16 or something. Like, think about that. You know, we look at a lot of these artists, the pioneers, the legends, as like larger than life. They were kids. And I and the fact that they figured out, especially during like the big blackout in the Bronx, you know, they figured out how to make this work and how to, you know, take it to the streets and plug in sound systems into light posts and throw these parties, all of these kids congregating within the same, you know, city blocks. That was just something that just wowed me because of the age. But then when you add women, girls, mm-hmm. young girls to the mix, having to go down there and try to get the guys to let them even get on the mic to perform. And, you know, as hip hop grew in popularity, as the artists got a little older in the space, right, you see the issues being very different, right? More mature problems. But when you're talking about like the issues that the female pioneers endured, we're talking about like guys like hopping fences and unplugging their like stereo or their sound system so that they can't perform with sound, and then them saying, could you plug it back in? And they're saying, do it yourself. Like things that think are just like these little childish battles. But it's just there's an innocence to it, right? And I think even though you had a lot of artists during that time who were like party rocking, but then you also had artists who were discussing what was going on in the crack epidemic, there's still this innocence to the art form, right? It's still very young. And there was something I just loved being able to hear those stories about that time period. It was like this return to innocence that once you strip away the billions of dollars that hip hop has now mm-hmm. earned and how it's the number one genre that's surpassed rock and roll, when you take all of that away and you just focus in on the fact that like we're talking like 1977 and it's a bunch of kids in a park and they're young, super young. There was just something that, you know, hit the heart when you're reading about it or hearing about it and then later getting to retell it into a book. It was magical.
Mm-hmm. Great. I was just wondering, like, is there, like, were there issues of, I don't know if the word is misogyny, like, or sexism? Did you find out about something about that? Because the artists in the 90s, like the women, they seemed so self-confident, like mm-hmm. really actually like role models for young women like me at that time. They seemed very confident, very strong. But have you like heard of anything that went on behind the closed doors? Like, did they have to fight sexism and things like that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, when you're talking about like the late 80s, like Moni Love, when Moni first got here from the UK, and you know, she tried to go to some of these parties to rock on the mic, and guys all thought she was really pretty, and they were trying to date her. You know, she shaved her head, she taped her breasts down, she wore really baggy clothes because she didn't want anyone to try to, you know, hypersexualize her, and she just wanted people to listen to her. So to have to do that, I think, is crazy, but so bold and so brave of her to do that. But even like, you know, Lil' Kim, you know, the Notorious B.I.G., rest in peace, when he was, I guess, building what was his female artist for Bad Boy, you know? Bad Boy. I mean, she wasn't signed to Bad Boy, but as part of, you know, his crew, the Junior Mafia, all of that. When Biggie was kind of figuring out what he wanted Lil' Kim to represent, you know, I have a story of him going shopping for these like seductive clothes without her, right? Mm-hmm. And just kind of handing them to her, like, here, put this on.
Wow, like the pretty girl. Yeah, like a doll.
Right. And, but also, you know, her wanting to write more lyrical rhymes and him saying you have to talk about sex and, you know, you have to make guys want this out of you or that out of you. And I think, you know, it worked. And then to release that music, and then have the media call you raunchy or rip you apart for it. I think that the greatest piece of the Little Kim success story is the fact that she became iconic after Biggie passed away.
Mm.
Because what it showed was that she didn't necessarily need a man kind of, you know, behind the driver's seat. It was
true.
A tragedy, you know, and especially
true.
Since,
I never,
you know, Biggie was the love of her life. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was tragic. The death of Biggie was tragic. He was a, you know, hip hop legend. But
mm-hmm.
Specifically speaking about Little Kim, the fact that it was only after he passed away that Little Kim became an icon. So all of you're reading all these things about how, you know, Biggie made Kim and all of that. Kim became the queen bee, like 2 years after, you know, or I mean, we're talking by the time like La Bella Mafia came out and, you know, Notorious K.I.M. That's when she became the iconic Little Kim.
True. I never thought about it like that. Yeah, it's true.
Yeah. So, but to know that in those early years when Hardcore came out, or even right before with the Junior Mafia project, the idea that everyone was just kind of assuming that she didn't have what it takes to be just this bold, brave, just brazen artist, you know, she proved them all wrong. And I think that was wonderful. But, you know, women of that era in particular, they endured a lot. You know, there was a lot of abuse, physical, mental, mm-hmm. you know. It was a time period that, you know, you would see just these artists who presented as so confident, but behind closed doors, you know, it was a different story. After I had already submitted my book, well, it would have been interesting to tell this, you know, I was doing another project. I was speaking with someone who was talking about stylists during the 90s. And one of the stylists had talked about how they used to have to, one of the biggest tasks was covering up black eyes on some of the female artists. Yeah.
Oh my God. Wow.
Mm-hmm. So you think about that, right? Mm. And then you're
We know it about the era of like Tina Turner, like back in the like way back, you know,
mm-hmm.
like we're not talking hip hop, but we knew that that happened then, and they were like abused and used, yeah, for money,
right?
But yeah, I think if you look at where they're like. Well, how they look now, like Foxy Brown and Lil' Kim and even Lauryn Hill, like they look like there has been some trauma in their lives. And I don't know if it's been because of the music, but I think there was something happening at that time that was really not healthy, probably.
Well, you know, I think it's hard, you know, to say that like, oh, someone looks like something has happened in their lives, because sometimes people can look amazing and have had, you know, these horrible traumatic experiences. And then maybe somebody hasn't had traumatic experiences and they just, you know, don't present as confidently. But mm-hmm. what I do think is that those artists during that chunk of time were asked to deliver in a way that no male artist has been asked to deliver,
hmm.
right? And that can take its toll on anyone, right? If you're, you know, you're talking about artists who, when Foxy Brown was signed, was like 15 years old, Little Kim was like 15, 16, you know, Lauren, I think, was like 18, 19, I want to say, maybe hmm. younger. But not even anywhere near adulthood yet, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're being asked to dress a certain way and, you know, look a certain way, rhyme a certain way, have a certain level of success. The lightning is demanded, you know, to strike twice. Like, you just got to keep the hits coming. It wasn't like today where if your first song on Spotify doesn't do as well, you could follow up tomorrow with another one, right? That's mm-hmm. It was an entirely different business model. So if you didn't deliver with that one project, the pressure was on or if you did deliver, the pressure was on for the next one.
For the next one, yeah.
Yeah, like the sophomore curse, they called it, right? And it's something that I think artists across the board experience with female hip hop artists in particular. It was stressed. And I think just how the industry just treats Black women,
mm-hmm.
you know, you're just the it's ridiculous and it's unfair. And I think the fact that, you know, it's just a testament to their strength to be able to still hold it together. I mean, I can't even imagine what it must have been like to be a female hip hop artist in the 90s. During that time period where at first they're throwing money at you and then by 99 they're taking all the money away and then they're telling you, look sexy, no, you're too sexy, like be lyrical, yeah. not lyrical enough, you know. And then, and I mean, add to that just the idea of like growing up as a woman, your body changes from like 16 to 18, you look completely different. I mean, so
totally.
Imagine like from 16 to 21 or to 27, you know, You might not look the same in that lingerie, right? You may gain weight, you may lose weight, you may have children, you know, you may get married, you may have to make decisions about your career that are never, ever asked of men.
That's true.
So, yeah, like, you add that all together, like, tell me how composed you'll be by then.
Yeah.
It's all that's touch, you know?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I think that's even a topic today, like looking at Nicki Minaj and Cardi B. Cardi B, like, kind of does what she does. Like, she doesn't even think too much about it. She does what she wants. But I think, like, Nicki Minaj was told to wait with the marriage and everything and kids, I think, like, 10 years ago. Yeah, I think so. This is not, has not stopped.
No, I think, and we can credit Cardi for being able to turn around and say, no, I think I'm gonna do my thing, but, you know, have fun. Which I think is amazing. I think somebody had to do it.
Yeah.
And, you know, every woman in hip hop is a part of this puzzle and they deliver something unique, even if it was like one song or one expression, one fashion choice. Like, every part plays a part. Every piece plays a part in the story.
Yeah.
And, you know, it is something to celebrate that Cardi just turned around and said, nope.
Yeah. So where do we stand now?
As far as women in hip hop right now in 2019?
Yeah.
Well, I think we're at a crossroads, right? Because, you know, from a business perspective, the way women in hip hop are being regarded as is like this like subgenre, right? Like, they're regarding women in hip hop the way they regarded SoundCloud rap or mumble rap, like, you know, the hot new craze. Like if you have hip hop, there's trap, you know, there was drill for a while, there was gangster rap, there's women. That's how I see the business infrastructure treating women in hip hop right now, as they're their own collective subgenre based upon gender alone, which I think is a little ridiculous, right? But I think it's building an awareness around the women who are out. So that's great. But I'm curious to see what will happen in the next year or two. When we have a new quote unquote craze in hip hop, are you going to just regard the women in hip hop as just a subgenre that's now been tossed to the side? Or are you going to actually acknowledge that these artists are amazing and they're making hits and they're contributing, you know, to the culture in a way that other artists have never done? Like, I want to make sure, you know, that this is something that will stick and it'll be honored appropriately. And not just regarded as its own little tiny corner.
Yeah.
So, you know, I have hope, you know, especially because there's so many cool artists that that don't even sound alike, right? Like, there's just so many cool female artists that, you know, sound nothing alike. You can't possibly put them all in one category. But when you do talk about the artists, there's always just like, it's always a question, like everyone's in their own group. Like, you know, I want to have a conversation that says Kendrick Lamar, J. Cole, and Rhapsody.
True.
And, you know, where she's not regarded as a female hip hop artist as a part of a whole. You know, Megan Thee Stallion can stand alone as Megan Thee Stallion. We don't need it to be a Megan Thee Stallion, Nicki Minaj, City Girls conversation, you know, although they're all dope. You know, we don't need that. Right. Like there should be you should be able to talk about Cash Doll without reminding people that, you know, Asian DeBrat was Asian Doll at some point. Like, you know what I mean? Like there doesn't have to be like three dolls in a row. It's like, why not just this one artist, what they're doing, and then as an artist and not just a female hip hop artist, which I think is still, again, an issue that's been going on for decades.
Yeah. I'm always trying to support so-called female artists. Like I try to support women. Mm-hmm. But then again, like I'm always very hesitant when I use the hashtag female rap artists because I hate it in a way. I mean, in one way it helps support them, but, then again, I feel like there should not be a female in it. Like she's a rap artist, you know.
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword. Because you want to be given the proper space to be recognized. I'm assuming, but then at the same time, you don't want to be too sectioned off, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. So I can't wait to, for your book to come out. You already said it will be available on October 22, and there'll be a Kindle edition. So I think I'm going to get that one.
Great.
Over here in Germany. And at the end of the interview, I always ask two questions.
Mm-hmm.
One is, in what way do you think hip hop can be a healer?
Hmm. Wow, that's a great question. Can I get like super like nerdy and scientific?
Yes, please.
Okay.
Do.
Well, you know, emotionally speaking, and I guess, you know, spiritually speaking and even poetically speaking, I think a lot of hip hop lyrics can heal people, especially if they're going through something and they find a point of relatability, right? I think that's how hip hop can be a healer, because it can emotionally heal you from within. But another thing is, in hip hop production, the ability to create binaural beats that when you listen on a headphone, on headphones, transmit into your brain differently and calm your brain waves, they can heal you in a whole other way. You know, binaural beats, you know, are known to calm you, put you in a meditative state, cure anxiety. So there's two different ways that I feel hip hop can heal you.
Yeah, thank you. And the other question is, like, what was your greatest musical experience? It can be a concert or just a song or an artist or maybe you rapping your soap opera songs.
Well, you know, the being able to see Lauryn Hill perform like 12 times, I think, was a big deal for me musically.
Wow, 12 times. Like, when was that? Was it in the 90s?
Yeah, I went a bit overboard. Like, I think I did like 4 concerts a year. It was a lot. There was a lot going on.
Amazing.
But I'm glad I got it all. I packed it all in. No, it was probably like 10 during the 90s, and then I caught 2 more over the years that followed. But the experience, and I have to say, the experience that was the most mind-blowing with hip-hop for me was going to the listening session for Jay-Z and Kanye West's Watch the Throne.
Oh, my God. Okay.
So it was done at the Hayden Planetarium.
Is it a big place or?
It's a part of the Museum of Natural History.
Oh my God.
So you went in and you got to the front and it was one of those like really, really exclusive events.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you went in and you walked in and you had to surrender everything but a pen and a piece of paper or a notebook.
Oh my God.
Like all of your anything, like, you know,
Yeah, that sounds so like Kanye and Jay-Z. Yeah.
Okay, right. Absolutely. So, yeah, that you had to hand it all in, right? You went in there, and then there was like this like little cocktail hour in this in the main space, which was pretty cool. They had like miniature versions of just the most the craziest things. Like think of like luxurious food and then shrink it down. So then
they're so extra.
They are, but it was like, oh, it was just the right amount of extra. So you walk up, they usher you in to walk up this long staircase, and Kanye West is at the door greeting you.
Oh my God.
Okay. And you're like, hi, you know, whatever. And then you go and you sit down, and it was like stadium seating, right? Like the way it's like this kind of a round venue, and you're all sitting, and you're in these chairs, right? And then in the ceiling are constellations, you know, like, so what they did was the lights went out and all you saw were stars and constellations as the album played.
Wow.
And then you turn, then they turn on the lights when it's over. And like, you didn't know what was going on, but when you turn on the lights, you turn and you look to your right and Beyonce is sitting there, Gayle King, like Kelly Rowland, Kanye, Jay-Z, like, and you're like, what?
The where living room. Yeah.
Right. Casual. But it's like you're, but the, you didn't see, like, we didn't see any of these people come in, right? Because you're in pitch like darkness. So the lights come on and then like, they're all sitting there like looking at you like, hey, so what'd you think? And it's like, whoa. So it was one of those experiences that when I think about that album and when I listen to that album, I'm brought right back to that moment of like complete darkness with the stars above. And I just think about that. And I think like that is just a perfect example of like how listening sessions and just the right mood and the right environment and the right ambiance can completely change your perception of a project, which is why I always say like, listen to an album in the car during dusk to get a real feel for how you like it or not. But
yeah, that's just, yeah.
You know.
Wow, I never liked that album so much, but I'm going to listen to it right now and think of that.
Yeah, get some glow in the dark stars for your ceiling.
I will. Like there's this almost still full moon out there, and I'm gonna give it the full experience.
Exactly. That's
wow, amazing. Thank you so much, Kathy Yandeli.
Thank you so much for having me.
For the interview, and then I can't wait to have the book coming out.
Thank you. I'm excited. Thanks, Anna.